This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today.
Baby, can't you see I'm calling? A guy like you should wear a warning. It's dangerous. I'm falling.
That was Toxic by Britney Spears. Its release in 2004 was the latest in a string of hits by the pop superstar, dating back to her debut album, released in 1999 when she was 17. But in 2008, after a public unraveling of her life and clashes with the paparazzi, Spears was placed under a conservatorship. Her father, Jamie, made most of her decisions for her. Spears' public fight to get out from under this arrangement has shone a spotlight on a system rarely considered by the general public. Emily Yar is a pop culture reporter for The Washington Post. She has been following this story. She joins us here on All Sides to get the latest on this case. Emily, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start at the beginning for folks who perhaps only recently have caught up with this and are sort of playing catch up at what's going on here. We talked about how there were some issues that were out in public with Britney Spears and her clashes with the media and some things that was going on in TMZ and places like that. Why did her family pursue the conservatorship back in 2008?
So I think the breaking point really happened in early 2008. Like you mentioned, she had, kind of been unraveling very, very publicly, it seemed like. I think the two incidents that people probably remember is when she shaved her head and when she hit paparazzi's car with an umbrella. And after that, she was placed under two separate psychiatric holds in the hospital. And it was right around then that her family stepped in and decided to seek a conservatorship, and they said at the time to basically save her life.
So in the court, how it works is they have to go to a court, correct?
Yeah, they had to petition the court and show evidence that she needed this, because a conservatorship is typically, it's a legal structure used for people usually that are elderly, maybe someone with dementia or people that are seriously ill. So yeah, it was a pretty drastic step to take at the time, but that's what they felt was necessary to help her.
Do you know if they considered a middle step? Where is there a middle step? We'll talk about this later with the legal experts as well. But is there a middle step? Because you hear of folks who are undergoing a serious mental illness issue, and the family comes in and basically forces them into treatment. Was that a step they considered, or they just went full in for the conservatorship?
Yeah, it's unclear what the conversations were like at the time, but it seemed like it was clear also from the beginning that they thought the conservatorship, while kind of a drastic step, was going to be temporary. It seems like from reporting that's come out since then that this was not intended to be a permanent arrangement. And so I think that is why the situation has sort of spiraled into what it's become now.
Britney Spears continued to perform, produce albums throughout this conservatorship. What were the parameters? What are the parameters for her making money and her ability to control her money and spend her money?
Yeah, I mean, once you're in a conservatorship, there are sort of two different parts of it. One is the conservatorship of your finances, and one is for you as a person. So she's pretty much, she really ceded all control to all of those things. She had no access to her money. She was given a weekly allowance. Her father and the co-conservators, decided who could see her, when she could travel, when she would perform, when she would go on tour. So yeah, pretty much every basic decision in her life, those decisions were made by someone else.
Now, the conservatorship was pursued in 2008, and reportedly in 2014, so 6 years later, Britney Spears questioned her father's role in the conservatorship. Do you know what happened between 2008 and 2014? Was she okay with the arrangement during that time?
Very little is known about that time, because this whole situation really has been very almost shrouded in secrecy. There have been so many layers between Britney Spears and anyone who's really wanted to ask her any questions, really since 2008. And from what the public saw, shortly after she was hospitalized, I think about 6 months later, she was back in the studio. She was recording albums. She was on tour. She was on How I Met Your Mother as a guest star. She had a Vegas residency. So from the outside, it looked like she was doing a lot better. And maybe the conservatorship was part of that. And so, yeah, she had made a few comments. There was a documentary where she likened the conservatorship to a jail. But otherwise, people really didn't know how she felt about it, at least publicly, until last month with her very explosive testimony about it.
Yeah, that's the testimony that really caught everyone's attention. Emily Yar is a pop culture reporter with The Washington Post. She joins us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the case of Britney Spears and also the legalities of guardianship, conservatorship here on 89.7 NPR News. Emily mentioned the June hearing, the testimony. It was explosive. She said she had been forced to work against her will. She had been blocked from marrying, blocked from removing her IUD. Because she wanted to have a baby. This was pretty incredible stuff. And that's when the story really, really took hold.
Yeah, definitely. Her testimony in June just had such an enormous impact because people really hadn't heard from her in over a decade. And the only way that fans were able to really see her was on her Instagram account. And for years, there had been, kind of what seemed like conspiracy theories at the time of, you know, this Free Britney movement that she's trapped in this conservatorship, and people started combing her Instagram for clues. So they were really going to pretty extreme lengths to try to figure out what she was thinking. And then when she, talked to the court, testified publicly in June, that was the first time people really got to hear what was on her mind, and she did not hold back. You know, she basically told the judge that this was an abusive arrangement, that she wants her life back. And yeah, some of the details she mentioned really, really shocked people. And it just, yeah, it had a really seismic impact.
Now, in response, her father, Jamie Spears, filed documents basically saying he hasn't controlled at least her finances for 2 years, right? What's he saying?
Yeah, he said that, so he basically, since late 2019, he said he has had nothing to do with her conservatorship of the person. So the thing she was saying, that she's, you know, not allowed to get married, not allowed to have her IUD removed, he said he has nothing to do with that. And that's all in the hands of another co-conservator, a woman named Jodie Montgomery. And he has been co-managing her conservatorship on the finance side, but he said he was very hurt by her testimony and he had nothing to do with a lot of the charges she leveled at the time.
So it's not just Jamie Spears. There is another entity involved. Do we know, because his name is the one that's associated with her, but do we know the responsibility or what the allegations are with regards to the other entity involved?
Yeah, so Jodie Montgomery is the conservator who is in charge of her as a person. And Britney hasn't talked as much about her. She's made it very clear she no longer wants to be in a conservatorship. But really all that's come out from Jodie Montgomery's side is that she said she has received so many death threats after Britney's testimony in June that she has requested money for extra security from the court. So that's sort of the next step in this process. There's a hearing next week to figure that out, because she said, yeah, her life has been threatened since Britney made these claims.
Now, just at the end of June, the judge denied a request to remove Jamie Spears from the star's conservatorship. Do we know what the judge's reasoning there? Did he or she explain what was going on?
Well, it's not clear exactly what the specific reason was to remove him right now. But one big step forward in the case for Britney was that she was allowed to hire her own lawyer recently, which is something that has never been allowed since the start of the conservatorship. And that lawyer named Matthew Rosengart, he held a press conference this week and basically said their number one priority is to file a petition to have Jamie Spears removed. He called it, he said they're going to aggressively petition this. So I think that's going to be the big next step. And that seems to be Britney's priority.
Do we know how common these arrangements are in the entertainment industry, in the music industry, in Hollywood, New York, especially with performers who begin their careers young?
It seems pretty rare, and I think that's why this case has gotten so much attention, because this was sort of fans' point from the start in starting these Free Britney, this Free Britney movement, was that, you know, Britney's able to record albums and go on tour and be this international pop star, so why is she under this legal structure that restricts her every move? Again, conservatorships are typically for people that can't make these decisions. So I think the fact that this is happening to someone who is so famous and has such a huge platform has really caught people's attention, because then there are so many people that this affects you know, that are under these conservatorships that don't have Britney's resources. And you kind of wonder what's happening in those cases.
And as you said, this was really kind of hidden from the public. I mean, are these private matters by design? Are a lot of these records sealed? Because there are courts involved here. Judges make rulings, magistrates make rulings, but are they sealed legally to protect the privacy of all involved?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's why this is just coming out now after so many years. Because yeah, this was completely through the court system. Pretty much everything has always been sealed, so it's been really hard for journalists who want to cover this to get access to any of that. You know, of course, it involves medical documents as well, which are confidential. And I think another reason is that, you know, it involves Britney's mental health. And that was something that without solid sourcing, of course, no one wanted to speculate on that. And people around Britney weren't talking. So yeah, this all involved very, very private documents and systems. And I think that's sort of another thing that's interesting about this is it was so hard to report on. And now that it's all coming to light, you really wonder what else could have been missed by the fact that this has all really been sealed.
Yeah, you can see the reason why these records are private, because you don't want to get into somebody's private, you know, health records. They deserve privacy for that. But on the other hand, lack of transparency also can hide misdeeds or wrongdoing. So that's the balance that I'm sure the courts and journalists are having to deal with. Where do we go from here? You mentioned that she is trying to get her own attorney now. What's the next step in this case?
Yeah, so the next step, so they have not officially filed anything to end the conservatorship. So I guess the next step, her lawyer has said, is to try to remove Jamie Spears. And I imagine after that, they will try to figure out how to get her out of the conservatorship in general. Again, nothing has been filed, but Britney has made her wishes very clear now publicly a couple times. So I would imagine that's sort of what we're going to see. And again, it's all going to be through the court system.
There have been calls for her dad to step down voluntarily. Any idea that if that's going to happen, has he given an indication he would do that?
It doesn't seem like it right now, since he's still there and still filing things to the court. So it seems like going to be around at least for a little while longer, and then it'll be interesting to see what happens now that she has a new attorney for the first time in more than a decade.
Do we know what his financial stake in this is? I mean, is he getting paid? Does he get a certain percentage of her earnings? Is he controls it all, I guess, that in this co-conservator?
Yeah, so according to some of the documents that have been found recently, he got paid quite a bit over the years from being her co-conservator, and that was sort of something fans also pointed to, was the fact that maybe, you know, theorizing that the reason that she's been in this conservatorship for so long, even though she seems to be very productive, is that the people around her had a lot to gain from that. You know, she's worth, I believe the latest reporting in the New York Times that her estate is worth $60 million. And so he has definitely been making money from that over the years.
Yeah, that's follow the money, as they say, right? In the old cliche, the old adage. Emily Yar, pop culture reporter for The Washington Post. She has been monitoring the Britney Spears story for The Post, and we thank you for joining us here on All Sides.
Great. Thank you so much.
When we come back, we'll talk about some of the legal issues. How does one land in a conservatorship? How do you end a conservatorship? We'll talk to a couple legal experts when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm your host, Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. The fight to free Britney Spears from her conservatorship has brought to the fore issues that disability rights advocates have long sought to address. In June, Spears described the impact of the conservatorship to a California judge.
After I've lied and told the whole world I'm okay and I'm happy, it's a lie. I thought I said that enough. Maybe I might become happy because I've been in denial. I've been in shock. I am traumatized. You know, fake it till you make it. But now I'm telling you the truth, okay? I'm not happy. I can't sleep. I'm so angry, it's insane, and I'm depressed.
An estimated 1.3 million Americans live under some form of conservatorship. Advocates hope the spotlight currently on the system will lead to reform. Joining us on All Sides is Jasmine Harris, is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. Her research focuses on the role disability rights plays in the larger context of anti-discrimination. Jasmine Harris, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much, Mike. Great. Glad to be on the show.
And also, Jonathan Martinez is the Senior Director for Law and Policy for the Burton Blatt Institute at Syracuse University. He's the author of the book Supported Decision Making, From Justice for Jenny to Justice for All. Supported Decision Making is an Alternative to Conservatorship. Jonathan Martinez, welcome to All Sides.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Jonathan, we'll start with you. In a basic sense, why do we have conservatorships, guardianships?
The idea of conservatorships and guardianships, and they are essentially the same thing, goes back to the Roman Empire. And I kid you not, about 1,500 years ago, there was an emperor named Justinian, and I am such a legal geek, I named one of my sons Justin after him. Justinian got all of the laws in the Roman Empire together at one time in a book called the Justinian Code. That was the first time we had laws in one place in the Western world, that we had rights in one place in the Western world. And one of those laws said, if you are feeble-minded, their words, you had to have a curator over you to make decisions for you. So 1,500 years ago, the first time we had rights in one place, we had a way to take them away. That's become what I call an expectation or a culture that has continued to this day with the assumption that if a person is in some way, quote unquote, limited, they need someone over them to do things for or instead of them.
Now you mentioned that conservatorship and guardianship are basically synonymous. I think in Ohio, it's we call them guardians here. How hard is it to gain that status where you do take control of someone who has limited capacity?
As the law says, especially in Ohio, it should be very hard, but in practice, it's very easy. The idea of guardianship, and they are essentially the same thing as conservatorship, they're different only in names, is that if a person truly is unable or incapable of making decisions or truly cannot exercise his or her rights, what a judge is supposed to do is take those rights the person truly cannot exercise and give them to someone else. That other person becomes the guardian or conservator. What we know, unfortunately, from study after study after study, is that it's become what one study calls standard operating procedure for people with disabilities. In fact, the fastest growing segment of the population going into guardianship are 18-year-olds with disabilities. So it's actually, and unfortunately, quite easy to say that a person can't do something and therefore shouldn't be allowed to do it.
Jasmine Harris from the University of Pennsylvania, you have researched the role of disability rights in the context of discrimination and anti-discrimination. How do you see this conservatorship? Where is it done well, and where is there need for reform, if there is need for reform?
Well, I think I want to start by saying the reform, the calls for reform that we're seeing now, assume that guardianship is a legitimate legal institution anywhere. And so assuming that that premise is accepted, which many disability rights advocates and researchers say may not be the case, that there are alternative systems that could be in place. But assuming that it is a system that is legitimate, one that we want, that makes sense, then who's doing it well? Quite frankly, Mike, I think that most states are not doing it well. And as Jonathan said previously, a lot of it has to do not necessarily with this specific text of the law, but more so with the application. And a lot of that has to do with a fundamental misunderstanding of what legal capacity is.
Jasmine Harris, it sounds like you think that the law needs to be scrapped and we need to come up with something different. Is that what you're saying?
So you're asking me, Mike, for my opinion about the institution of guardianship. Institution. And I would say, I would say that, yes, I think that we need to start from square one and we need to think about what is the goal of the system rather than placing additional band-aids on it. What are we trying to do? And it has to do with decision-making support. And so what kind of system would make sense? I think, you know, if you keep putting band-aids on something that is a wound that is forever open, you're just delaying the inevitable. And so we're starting from a premise that is wrong.
We're talking about conservatorship here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Of course, the case of Britney Spears has brought this issue toward the forefront. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're looking for folks who are directly involved in these types of arrangements, perhaps an attorney or someone who has been under conservatorship, has a loved one under a conservatorship. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jonathan Martinez from Syracuse University. You mentioned that this dates back 1,500 years when the, quote, feeble-minded needed to be taken care of. How much of this is our understanding of mental illness and treatments of mental illness has advanced that perhaps has made guardianship, conservatorship an outdated way to protect folks? And I use that in quotes, I guess.
That's a tough question, Mike, because there's so much that we can say has gotten better, but at the same time, there's so much that has stayed the same for 1,500 years. I say that the biggest problem with guardianship, and I don't think that guardianship is inherently wrong. I think when it works the way it's supposed to, good things can happen, but I think it ought to be the last resource. But I don't think it's the thing that is inherently evil. For example, my sister is the guardian of my godson, and thank God for it, because she empowers him to live a better life. But the problem that we face time and time and time again is what I call a problem of culture or expectation that has come from 1,500 years ago to today. We expect, society seems to expect, that people with disabilities can't do things, that needing help to do something means you can't do them. And that is different from the way that we treat every other person. For every other temporarily able-bodied person, which is what I call people without disabilities, because we're all 1 second away from having disabilities. Whenever we ask for help, whenever we say we can't do something or seek out assistance in something, we are called wise. We're getting a second opinion. We're making an informed judgment. A person with disability says, I don't understand. Can you explain that to me? Or I need help doing something. Well, for 1,500 years, we've made a societal assumption that that person can't do things, or worse, isn't worthy of doing things. We are sitting here 31 years after the Americans with Disabilities Act finally said that people with disabilities should have the same rights as everyone else. 214 years after the Declaration of Independence said we're all created equal, mind you. But in 1990, we said as a people that people with disabilities are created equal. And yet today, we have approximately 1 million more people in guardianship than we did just 25 years ago. We've lost a generation and they've lost their rights. We need to do better.
Jasmine Harris, how does a court decide if a conservatorship or a guardianship is the correct course of action?
That's a great question, Mike. Before I answer the question, if I may just jump in.
Please.
With respect to what Jonathan was saying and your previous question, Mike, about how would we think about reform or the legitimacy of the institution? And I do want to say that one fundamental problem is the lack of transparency. And so some of the debate that's happening right now is in a kind of a void because we do have some information. You mentioned 1.3 million people under conservatorship or guardianship in this country. We don't know. We don't know exactly how many people are under it, how long they've been under it, and how, and this is an important question, how they found themselves to be under conservatorship in the first place. And so even with a case like Britney Spears, we see this issue of privacy attached to disability and being used as a sword to shield potentially abuse, bad actors, et cetera. And so my work has really focused on this question of the association of privacy and disability. So let me just shift very quickly, Mike, to your question about how does one find themselves under conservatorship. The judge has to make a legal decision and make a decision with respect to a standard. And in every state, the standard is somewhat different, but it's with respect to the person. If you have guardianship over the person, conservatorship over the person, it's going to be, can they take care of themselves? Can they meet the legal standard of without that help, they are going to be in danger, right? And so it's a pretty high standard, as Jonathan said, and this is something that is going to really fall out in the interpretation of it. What does that mean? And so that's why Jonathan mentions culture. It is a high legal standard.
And is it permanent? Is it reviewed often? I mean, that's one of the things that Britney Spears is saying, that, look, I'm doing much better now. This was imposed back in 2008, 2009. I can handle it now. I mean, how often is it reviewed? Do we know?
I think, you know, going back to the privacy data point, I think that's a huge question. However, there are, depending on the state, again, there are provisions for a review, a regular review. For example, in California, we're talking about 2 years. There's an investigator that should meet with the conservatee and meet with the conservator and have a review of things and ideally think about and ask, what are your express wishes? And so whether or not that is something that is happening on a regular basis, again, there's this lack of transparency that we're not able to really monitor what's happening. And in fact, what you're seeing at the federal level, Mike, is you're seeing a slew of representatives and senators coming forward and saying, gosh, the system is broken, we need to fix it. And some of them are focusing on this question of termination. When you have a power of attorney, there's a sunset provision, right? It's at the end of a year. But these laws that are coming forward, these bills that are being proposed, again, they start from the assumption that the system is okay where it is. We need just greater transparency, or we need to put in a quick fix of end it after 1 year.
We're talking about conservatorship, guardianship here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was Jasmine Harris. She's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us is Jonathan Martinez from Syracuse University. He directs the Law and Policy Institute at Syracuse. Jonathan, I mean, what happens if the person who is subject to this guardianship, who is under the conservatorship, who is disabled, has no advocate? I mean, if you're an elderly person, if you're a person that has to be who's looking out for them to say, you know what, I don't need this anymore, or I don't need as much oversight as this arrangement is providing. That has to be a catch-22 in some ways.
Absolutely. And that is something the Britney Spears case points out as clear as day. Consider what we're talking about today. Consider the events of last week. Last week, it was considered to be great news for Britney Spears that she got to choose her own attorney. Now think about what it is that we're calling great news. 13 years ago, Britney Spears went into conservatorship. 13 years later, she can choose her own attorney. If 13 years ago, Britney Spears had committed murder with an axe, if she was an axe murderer, she would have been able to choose her own attorney then. So what we're calling great news is that after 13 years, Britney Spears finally has the same rights as an axe murderer. Now think about the hundreds of thousands of people in guardianship, the 1.3 million that you said, the possibly more that we don't have data about. Think about how many of them don't have the right to choose their own attorney. Think about how many of them went into guardianship without an attorney. Think about how many of them have lost rights that we as Americans consider fundamental. Where to go, who to see, whether to work, whether to have children. All of the things Britney Spears brought up are being faced by hundreds of thousands of people who have had no one to speak with them, because even though they've lost the same rights as people in jail, they don't have the same opportunities as people in jail. We have got to do better as a society.
Jasmine Harris, how do folks who are under conservatorship, who is advocating for them? Maybe you've researched this and the disability rights. If at least 1.3 million people are subject to this or under this conservatorship or guardianship arrangement, there's not that many advocates to go around.
So that assumes that there is a right to counsel by statute or otherwise. And that's just not the case, Mike. We don't have a situation where every state says you have a right to counsel. It will be provided for, it will be paid at the public expense. And as Jonathan mentions, that you will choose this counsel, right? And this is a distinction from the criminal justice system. The whole system itself is structured in a way that assumes that it's acting in the best interest of the individual. And so because of that, you have many procedural quirks like the ones that we're hearing about in the media, where Britney Spears is paying for lawyers on all sides. Basically, she's paying for everyone in that courtroom except for the judge. And so it is a very quirky legal institution, again, premised on the notion of best interest. So there are lawyers that she can have. There is also the conservator that is appointed can either be a private conservator that is like the petitioner, Jamie Spears, or it can be someone that is a public conservator or guardian that is arguably independent, but also someone, if the individual doesn't have a deep network, that will be appointed for them.
And that's what we're talking about, someone who we see that a lot with elderly folks who are, they reach a point in life where they you know, because of dementia or other issues, can't control their finances. That's where the court would step in, and they don't have any family members that would step in and appoint a legal guardian, correct?
That's correct, but I also want to point out that this is a phenomenon that happens, it's also along class lines. And so, you know, what is the type of network that one has in terms of the support and access to support? You could imagine someone could hire individuals if they had the means and money. And so that's why something we haven't talked about yet is the disproportionate impact on not only people with disabilities, not only people who are poor or low income, but individuals who are people of color and exist along other marginalized identities.
All right, we'll get to that, and we'll talk more about conservatorship and guardianships and what's the middle ground. We'll try to answer that question when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about conservatorships and how the conservatorship of Britney Spears has been under fire now. She's been under conservatorship for 13 years. It's now sparking a conversation about a system that affects millions of Americans. Still with us is Jonathan Martinez, the Senior Director of Law and Policy for the Burton Blatt Institute at Syracuse University. Also Jasmine Harris, Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Carey School of Law. We want to go to the phones. Mark from Clintonville. Mark from Clintonville, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, or good morning, I should say. I'm a critical care nurse, and we all too often have patients come into the ICU completely debilitated, lacking any capability or capacity to make decisions. And there is no provision for us to establish an emergency guardianship because we cannot find any family. They may not have any family. They may have been estranged from their family for years and have no contact with them. And we have no mechanism in place to address this. There's, you go to the courts asking for an emergency guardianship, and they basically laugh at you. And there needs to be a mechanism in place to address this until either a family member can be found who can assume decision-making status for those patients, or it can sometimes take 3 months to get a guardianship established.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Let's get an answer. Jasmine Harris, are we talking about the same thing here? we're at an emergency, you need someone to help make decisions right away versus a more of a longer term thing?
Well, I think they're part and parcel of the same concept. I think in response to the caller, this is why one of the strategies in terms of alternatives to guardianship is pre-planning, is to think about powers of attorney, think about the person's wishes in times of need, so that in those when they may lack capacity to make decisions, the wishes are clear. And so that is one way in which you can prevent the emergency situation. And I understand the caller, sometimes you can't locate it, but the issue of guardianship that we're talking about, again, that's just a small piece of it, yeah. But it is an important piece. Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, you've been the legal representative for folks trying to get out of a guardianship they do not want. You represented Jenny Hatch in the so-called Justice for Jenny case back in 2013. What was that case all about? Can you give us a quick synopsis?
Sure. Jenny Hatch was a 29-year-old woman who her entire life made all her decisions. She had Down syndrome, but she made all her own decisions like everyone else. She had a job, an apartment, a life, a church, friends. Then one day she was hit by a car in an accident that caused no impact to her cognitive abilities, did not change her ability to think or make decisions. But she found herself on the receiving end of a petition for guardianship filed by her mother and stepfather. And in 3 hours in a small courtroom in Newport News, Virginia, before I ever met Jenny, Jenny walked into that courtroom having all her rights, with the right to choose what to do and say and work and how to live her life, walked out with nothing. Walked out with her guardians able to control where she lived, whether she got medical care, who she could see, where she worked. So by the time I met Jenny, she was living in a group home, even though she wanted to live with friends. She was working in a sheltered workshop, making less than minimum wage, even though she wanted to go back to her job and was welcome to return there. She wanted to go to her church and was told, get used to your new life. We go to another church. If you wanted to see or speak with Jenny, you had to fill out a permission slip saying what you were going to do and where you were going to go and agreeing not to speak to her about the guardianship. So by the time I met her, that was her situation. And we spent a year in court arguing that Jenny, in her own words, did not need a guardian. She just needed a little bit of help. The same kind of help that we all need. Every single person needs help making decisions. We all have people we go to ask for advice in times of need. Except, as I told you, where that's a virtue for people without disabilities, it's a sin for people with disabilities because society assumes they can't do things. So we spent 6 days in trial in that little courtroom arguing that the way Jenny makes decisions, what we call supported decision making, is and should be an alternative to guardianship. Because if she can make decisions and direct her own life with the same help we all get, well, then she can make decisions and should not have a guardian. And after a year and 6 days in trial, the court agreed. The judge was the first judge at a trial to rule that a person should be empowered to use supported decision making, should be allowed to choose where to live and work and who to be with and what type of medical care she gets. And from that time, I've called Jenny the rock that starts the avalanche, because since then, 12 states in the District of Columbia have passed laws formally recognizing supported decision-making as a preferred alternative to guardianship. And there are projects and movements in I think, every state.
Yeah, the book Jonathan Martinez wrote after that case is Justice From Justice to Jenny, let me get this right now, supported decision-making from Justice for Jenny to Justice for All. That's the book written in 2019. Jasmine Harris, what is the middle ground? Because there is a need, because you can just see someone who cannot make their own decisions or someone who needs help making decisions, whether it's because of their age or a disability or a mental health issue, they could be vulnerable to fraud and getting ripped off and things like that. So where is there a middle ground? What is the middle ground? Is it this supportive decision making? Is there another system? Jasmine Harris.
So I think, Mike, that it's a complicated question, because it goes back to my initial point about, if we revisit the system, we have to ask what are we trying to fix, right? What is wrong here? And so as Jonathan mentioned, we have supported decision making is something that can be as informal as what we do every day in terms of making big decisions in our lives, consulting with family and friends, to something that is more formalized. And so what Jonathan's discussing and talking about here in terms of what states are doing is they're passing laws to make supported decision making a bit more formalized in terms of a contract. And in many ways, this is like a power of attorney. It is like an advance directive. It is something that is intended to build that scaffolding for decision-making around the individual. So with respect to alternatives to guardianship, I think we have to see this as, if we're going to reform the whole system, we have to come up with many different options, a continuum of options for individuals that they might use and might need. Again, as Jonathan said, people go in and out of a status of disability. We're all going to be in that position. And so because of that, we all ought to care about what happens here. And so the middle ground, I would say, is going to be a process. And we do live in a federal system. And so that it has to be something that is, it's actually the end product of debate and contestation. And that, to date, we haven't had.
And it is happening in Congress. Bills have been, or at least talked about. Jim Jordan, Matt Gaetz of Florida, they're pushing for hearings. Ted Cruz, Elizabeth Warren, you know, obviously opposite sides of the political fence there. They're looking for action in Washington. Jasmine, can this be solved at the federal level, or does each state have to do it?
I think you need a combination of both, quite frankly. And so I'm excited to see the federal intervention, but I'm cautiously optimistic. Again, you know, is this just an act of responding to Britney Spears as opposed to really taking a hard look at this system that is operating in all of the states and the District of Columbia? And so I would say that, yes, we have a moment here to really take a hard look at this. The federal system itself, one really concrete way that we can do this from the federal system, from the federal side, is we already have a system in place. It's called Protection and Advocacy Organizations. And by federal statute, in response to the publicity in the 1970s around these large-scale institutions like state institutions like Willowbrook, for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, as a result of those exposés, Congress stepped in and Congress said, we cannot have this happening. We need to have some monitoring. We need to have the representation for people with disabilities at the state level. And so they created, by statute, one protection and advocacy organization per state that is charged with investigating, monitoring, and representing people with disabilities in that state. And again, it's done through a form of spending legislation. It's done through a form where you can, states are going to have to do this if they want to receive the funds that are associated with it. So one really concrete solution is to grant these organizations greater funding. Give these organizations greater authority, investigative authority, and again, access, so that we finally get not only the data, but we have a system in place moving forward so that the data is clear and monitoring is present.
We're talking about conservatorships and guardianships here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was Jasmine Harris, professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us is Jonathan Martinez, a law expert from Syracuse University. Jonathan, there was an article some years ago in the Columbus Dispatch where they talked about this, and the gist of the investigation was that some attorneys were the guardians for a lot of people. And the thing that came out of that was that how can this attorney handle all of these cases? Have you seen that in your experience, that this article, this series basically dealt with older folks, elderly, suffering from dementia and Alzheimer's? Is the system taxed?
Short version, yes. The Richmond Times-Dispatch in Virginia did a similar expose last year, I believe. But to me, and revisiting what Professor Harris said, the issue is less the system and less the law and less the funding. All of those things changing would be helpful. What we need to do, though, is open minds and change attitudes. And that happens when we shine a light on problems, when we see articles like the Columbus series, like the Richmond Times series, and we say collectively, we have to do better. Just a hearing can cause attention and can cause that kind of light on it. But I would caution that that doesn't always change things either. In 1989, Congress had hearings on guardianship where a congressman named Claude Pepper said, the average ward person under guardianship has fewer rights than the average convicted felon. It's 32 years later. Things haven't changed. So it's on people like you and like me and like Professor Harris and everyone who is listening to say clearly, we can do better and we need to do better, and educate people to open minds to say, this isn't a fait accompli. Guardianship isn't an end unto itself. There are other ways that we can empower people. We should be trying other things first. If nothing works, guardianship is always an option. But morally speaking, before we take away rights that every American holds dear, shouldn't we try to empower people to use those rights? And if we have to take rights away, shouldn't we take as few away as possible? If we start with that message, then we can make change.
Jesmyn Harris, we want to get to the whole class issue. I can't help but think that if Britney Spears was male, this wouldn't have happened. Can you see this happening to a male pop star, and one of the new kids on the block, say, for instance, who also from that era? What role does gender play in this? What role does class and income level play in this?
I love the question, Mike, and I appreciate the reference to New Kids on the Block. The question of gender is salient here. We know from even just from Britney's case, think about the relationship between Jamie Spears and Britney Spears that predated 2008. And that relationship was rough and rocky, and Jamie Spears was going through several issues in his own life. And yet nobody questioned the fact that he could come into the court and petition and get a conservatorship, be appointed a conservator for his daughter. Because it was this narrative of here's this troubled young girl and here comes her father to save her. So there are gender dynamics apparent even in Britney Spears' case. If Britney Spears, let's say, was a member of New Kids on the Block or one of those other pop groups, I really would doubt that that would be the case, that someone would swoop in and say, at least you wouldn't have the kind of public narrative about her incapacity, right? It's a lot more believable to say, look, she shaved her head. I mean, that's pretty gendered as well. So there are all of these indications and even pieces of her story that were persuasive to a court that are highly gendered. And so in answer to your question, I think it would be a completely different story.
Jonathan Martinez, are you optimistic that this is the sea change moment? You wrote a book about it. There's a movie out there on Netflix called I Care a Lot, which talks about this, that was popular during the pandemic. Is this, with just a few seconds left, are you optimistic this is a sea change that this system needs?
If and only if we look at the broader issue. Free Britney can't just be about Britney any more than Justice for Jenny can be about Jenny. The message should not just be free Britney. It should be free the people. Justice for all of the Jennies. If we look beyond just the issue in front of us, then we can make changes. If we stop with Britney's story, then we are just going to continue something that's been going on for far too long already.
Okay. My thanks to Jonathan Martinez, Senior Director of Law and Policy for the Burton Blatt Institute at Syracuse University, author of the book Supported Decision Making from Justice for Jenny to Justice for All. Thank you for joining us, Jonathan. Also, Jesmyn Harris, Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Carey School of Law. Her research focuses on the role disability rights plays in the larger context of anti-discrimination. Thank you both for shedding some light on this very complex but important issue. That'll do it for All Sides. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann Fisher today on 89.7 NPR News.